This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the Gospel of Matthew. Now, here's Pastor Sandy in Matthew chapter 14 with today's edition of Sandy Adams Radio.
If you grew up in the 60s like me, you probably saw an episode or two of the show My Three Sons. Fred McMurray was the father, and his three sons were Robbie, Chip, and Ernie, and of course, Uncle Charlie also got into the action. The show ran for 12 years from 1960 to 1972. But another version of My Three Sons ran in ancient Israel during the first century. For when Herod the Great died, his kingdom was split among his three sons. Archelaus ruled over Judea and Jerusalem. You can check that on your map, sort of in the south of Palestine. Archelaus proved so cruel and so ineffective that the Romans banished him and set up a procurator in his place, or a governor, a Roman ruler. Philip was the second son. He was given the land north and east of the Sea of Galilee. He ruled over the Golan Heights. While Antipas ruled over Galilee and Perea. And this threw Antipas headfirst into conflict with both Jesus and John. Perea was east of the Jordan, parallel to Jerusalem. This was where John came baptizing. And the Galilee served as the headquarters for Jesus. Sadly, this Herod Antipas was a seedy, immoral, wicked fellow. His family life resembled a TV soap opera more than a sitcom. It was more like Days of Our Lives than My Three Sons. In fact, once on a trip to Rome, Antipas became infatuated with his niece and his sister-in-law, Herodias. Their adultery culminated with her divorce from Antipas's brother Philip, and she married Antipas. Herod Antipas, this Jewish king, had flaunted God's law. A Jewish king had both committed incest, committed adultery, and committed divorce. And when the pastor stood at the wedding ceremony and asked the question, "If anyone objects to this union, let him speak now or forever hold his peace," John the Baptist spoke up. He exposed the king's sin, and he angered the newlyweds. And that's where we pick it up in verse 1. At that time, Herod the Tetrarch. Now, just a little explanation. Herod the Great was a monarch. Antipas and Philip were each tetrarchs, which means quarter rulers. And Archelaus was called an ethnarch, or a racial or ethnic ruler. All these narcs sound like narcotics cops, don't they? But they were actually rulers, Roman rulers. Antipas and Philip were each given a quarter of Herod's kingdom. Their older brother, Archelaus, was given half of Herod the Great's kingdom before it was taken away by the Romans. And so, in order of rank, monarch was tops, tetrarch was lowest, and ethnarch was somewhere in between. Now, Herod Antipas, the tetrarch, built the city of Tiberias on the shore of the Sea of Galilee. It's there even today. Because Jesus and John ministered in the provinces of Galilee and in Perea, where Antipas was king, he was the ruler most often mentioned in the Gospels. Usually in the story of Jesus, when you run across a Herod, it's Herod Antipas. In fact, this is the man that in Luke 13, Jesus calls that fox. That's what he thought of him. Antipas was the Herod who would later try Jesus after his arrest and who sent him back to Pontius Pilate. This Antipas heard the report about Jesus and said to his servants, "This is John the Baptist. He has risen from the dead, and therefore these powers are at work in him." Notice a little paranoia in Herod. I mean, here's a guy who's suffering from a guilty conscience. You know, it's been said, a bad conscience has a good memory. God had used John the Baptist to speak to Herod, Yet Herod had silenced God's voice by killing John. And verses 1 and 2 show Herod's thoroughly pagan worldview. Remember, Jews didn't believe in reincarnation. But here Herod assumes that Jesus is John, back from the dead, seeking revenge. And it's Herod's paranoia that was grounded in superstition. Now, ironically, this Herod, he lived a life of luxury. He lived a life of ease. Yet obviously his guilty conscience trapped him in worry and in fear. That's what a guilty conscience will do. A conscience has been defined as that thing that hurts when everything else feels good. I like that. Herod's guilty conscience made him a miserable man. And in the next 10 verses, Matthew provides a flashback. He reveals the cause of Herod's guilty conscience. He says, "For Herod had laid hold of John and bound him, and put him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because John had said to him, 'It is not lawful for you to have her.'" Now, John didn't mince words. A Jewish leader had done an immoral deed, and John calls him on the carpet. In retaliation, this image-conscious king wants John swept under the rug. And so Herod arrests John, and he incarcerates him in the prison of Macarius, down by the Dead Sea. And although Herod wanted to put him to death, he feared the multitude because they counted him as a prophet. Now, Herod was a politician, and the king was acutely aware of public opinion. And he knew that the multitude of Jews really loved John. But there was more to this than just politics. I think Herod had a great respect for John. Mark 6, verse 20 tells us this. Herod feared John, knowing that he was a just and holy man, and he protected him. And when he heard him, he did many things and heard him gladly. John had purity and John had courage, the very traits that Herod lacked. I think John's only concern was pleasing God. Whereas for Herod, he had to consult the opinion polls before he brushed his teeth in the morning. And for a politician whose every decision is based on public opinion, John was to Herod a breath of fresh air. For a time, Herod listened to him. He had great respect for him. But things changed on his birthday. Verse 6. But when Herod's birthday was celebrated. Now, in Kathy's family, birthdays were always a very, very big deal. In our family, they were recognized, but it just wasn't the same for us. And it was one of those marital adjustments that I had to make a big deal out of birthdays. But in my family's defense, understand that the Bible isn't that big on birthdays either. In fact, there are only two birthdays mentioned in the Bible. Here and in Genesis 40, verse 20, the Pharaoh's birthday. And in both cases, somebody ended up decapitated. So forgive me if birthdays aren't that big a deal to me. Evidently, Herod's wife, Herodias, had arranged for Herod a very special birthday present. We're told the daughter of Herodias danced before them and pleased Herod. Her name was Salome. Long legs, tiny waist, hourglass figure. She was young and sexy and beautiful, and she had taken some belly dancing lessons. For she danced before King Herod. Understand, this was a stag party. The wine had been flowing for hours. The crowd started shouting for a little male entertainment. Usually, this kind of seductive dance was performed by a prostitute or by a professional dancer. Not often did a lady of standing, did a member of the royal court stoop to perform such a degrading deed, dance before these drunken men. But Herod was so impressed with Salome's dance, verse 7, therefore he promised with an oath to give her whatever she might ask. Mark tells us that Herod qualified his offer. Whatever you ask me, I will give you up to half my kingdom. Wow. So she, having been prompted by her mother, what kind of a mother prompts her daughter to do this, said, give me John the Baptist's head here on a platter. Herodias had manipulated this whole event. She had been scorned. John had dared to say that she was wrong, that she was immoral, that she had sinned, and now she was getting her retaliation and revenge. You know, it's sad when a mom teaches her own daughter the art of seduction and manipulation. This is not the way that a young woman should try to get ahead. And the king was sorry, nevertheless, because of the oaths and because of those who sat with him, he commanded it to be given to her. Now understand, you read this and you think, well, Herod didn't have an out. You know, if he wanted to save face, he had to go through. He had to go ahead and kill John the Baptist, but he did have an out. Because remember, he had offered a qualifier. He had limited his offer to up to half his kingdom. What he could have done, had he been thinking soberly, he could have told Salome that he valued John the Baptist more than half his kingdom. That would have ended the deal. Instead, all Herod could think about was his pride and how he might be perceived. And the opinions of his guests were more valuable to him than the life of the man of God. So he sent and he had John beheaded in prison. How ironic. John lost his head so Herod could save face. And sadly, Herod's decision gets repeated every single day at work, at school, in the halls of Congress. Conscience and truth are shoved aside simply to please people, to enhance someone's power among their peers. People are still trying to get ahead. It's interesting, in 39 AD, God served justice. Herod and Herodias were accused of treason against Rome. They were stripped of their wealth and power, and they were banished to Spain. In the end, the man who shunned God to get ahead ended up losing all. Verse 11 tells us, and his head was brought on a platter and given to the girl, and she brought it to her mother. Lust and power and ego always come at a high price. Then his disciples came and took away the body and buried it. You know, if Herod had buried his pride, the disciples wouldn't have had to bury John. And notice what John's disciples do with their pain and with their confusion. What we should be do when we're hurt and when we're reeling from that hurt. Notice what they do. And they went and told Jesus. Do you tell Jesus about your hurts and about your disappointments and about your pain? You should, for He cares. Now, when Jesus heard it, he departed from there by boat to a deserted place by himself. But when the multitudes heard it, they followed him on foot from the cities. Luke chapter 9, verse 10 says that they sailed northeast toward the fishing village of Bethsaida. And on a clear day, you can see all the way across the Sea of Galilee. Folks could have easily seen the disciples' boat. They were able to follow it on foot. They were following as it sailed across the water. They could kind of track it on foot as they walked along the shoreline. And when Jesus went out, he saw a great multitude. And he was moved with compassion and healed their sick. And as we said this morning, this word translated compassion is from the Greek word viscera or visceral. It speaks of deep emotions. The old King James uses the phrase bowels of compassion. Jesus felt for the multitudes in his gut. Now when it was evening, the sun was setting, his disciples came to him saying, "This is a deserted place and the hour is already late. Send the multitudes away that they may go into the villages and buy themselves food. There's not a Waffle House or a McDonald's for miles. Send the hungry crowd away before it's too late." John 6 tells us that this event took place near the Passover. That means that it was in the springtime. And the sun sets in Israel around 6 o'clock in the evening in the springtime. So it must have been around 4:30 when they made this statement. But Jesus said to them, "They do not need to go away. You give them something to eat." And of course, as we learned, they had no rations. Certainly not enough to feed 5,000 families. And they said to him, "We have here only 5 loaves and 2 fish." And again, the Gospel of John fills in some of the details. One little boy had packed a lunch, some fish and chips, 5 hand-sized loaves of bread, 2 sardine-sized fish. Andrew was the one who found the boy and brought his brown bag to Jesus. And Jesus said, "Bring them here to me." And then he commanded the multitudes to sit down on the grass, and he took the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, and looking up to heaven, he blessed and broke and gave the loaves to the disciples, and the disciples gave to the multitudes, and a miracle of multiplication took place. Jesus somehow altered the molecular structure of the bread and the fish so that each time a piece was broken off, it added to the volume. The little boy's brown bag refused to empty. And notice what Jesus did with the bread and the fish, because it is exactly what Jesus wants to do with your life and with my life. Here is the Master's fourfold work in our lives. First, he took the bread. And Jesus takes us, doesn't he? He takes us out of the world. He forgives us of our sin. He makes us his own. Second, Jesus blessed the bread. And isn't that what he does to us? He takes us out of the world. Then he blesses us with new life, with all spiritual riches in heavenly places in Christ Jesus. He pours on us God's favor and favors. Then finally, he gave the bread to his disciples to give to the multitudes. And Jesus gives us a way. He gives us to the people around us to serve them and to serve him and to minister the truth of the gospel and the love of Jesus to the people around us. All that we like, we want, we relish, we find right here in this verse. He takes us out of the world. He blesses us. Then he uses us. Isn't that what you want for your life? But whoa, wait 1 minute. Because we left something out, didn't we? Notice, between the blessing and the giving, he breaks the bread. Notice, he breaks the bread before he passes it out and gives it away. And this is also what he does to us. He takes us out of the world. He blesses us with his spiritual blessings. He uses us for his kingdom. But between the blessing and the using, he breaks us. He humbles us. And he breaks us of our pride and our self-sufficiency. And he reminds us what we would be like without him. Spiritually speaking, we are puny and powerless. We're nothing but a brown bag lunch. And guys, to be given away in service for Jesus, you first have to be broken. If you're not, you won't be digestible to the people you're trying to serve. People will choke on your haughtiness. You'll produce a case of spiritual indigestion in the people you're trying to minister to unless you're first broken. Before we're broken, we're hard and we're insensitive and we're self-sufficient and we're full of ourselves. And when a proud person tries to serve God, people will choke on our arrogance. We can't be swallowed. They just can't swallow us. That's why we have to be broken. And brokenness is a process. But God is faithful to fulfill that process. Guys, there are no shortcuts. If we want to be used by God, we first have to be broken. Verse 20. So they all ate and were filled, and they took up 12 baskets full of the fragments that remained. Now those who had eaten were about 5,000 men, besides women and children. Think about that. They had big families in those days. 5,000 families could have been 20,000 mouths. You can't get 20,000 people in Brookwood Stadium over there. That's a lot of people. Notice, too, the 12 baskets of leftovers. I love that. The 12 take-home boxes could have been for the 12 tribes of Israel. I think more probably Jesus had one basket of leftovers for each of the 12 apostles to teach them a lesson that he can turn our little into a lot. He can turn our meagerness into much if we'll bring it to Jesus. Verse 22. Immediately, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he sent the multitudes away. Notice Jesus made his disciples set sail. the word implies a strong urging. Evidently, the thrill of the multiplication had captivated them. They didn't want to leave the moment. But here he urges them to set sail. It's time to go. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Now, when evening came, he was alone there. And this was Jesus' habit, to retreat from time to time, to pray, to seek God. This would be a good habit for us as well. When life gets busy, it's best to get away, to come apart. And if you don't come apart and spend time with Jesus, you'll come apart. But the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary. A northeasterly had swept down from the Golan Heights, had hit the warm air above the lake, and a sudden storm had rocked the boat in the churning waters. Now the disciples had launched from the northeastern tip of the lake, Bethsaida, and they were sailing toward Gennesaret, which was south of Capernaum, still on the north side of the lake, but now over on the western shore. So here was the plan. They were sailing from the northeastern tip of the lake to its northwestern shore. Very, very short voyage. Should have taken just a few hours. But the storm pushed the boat all the way out into the center of the lake. And understand, the disciples are in trouble. Not because they were disobedient to Jesus. As a matter of fact, if they'd been disobedient, they probably would have stayed on the shore in a safe, dry house with chicken noodle soup in front of them. Probably would have been safe and secure if they had disobeyed the Lord. But instead, they had obeyed the Lord, and it got them into trouble. Do you know that sometimes obeying Jesus gets you into trouble? It's true. When you choose to obey Jesus, you will go against the flow of this world. And sometimes it creates conflict and difficulty. They encounter this storm and all its difficulty because they obeyed the Lord. You know, it's interesting, throughout its history, the church has compared itself to this little boat of disciples. The word nave is an old English word which referred to the main part of the church building, the nave or the sanctuary. But it is a Latin word that actually means ship. In other words, the church was always compared to this little ship. Obedience to God sends us in a direction that's contrary to the prevailing moods and the values of the world. Inevitably, followers of Jesus will encounter rough seas. Now, these were experienced sailors. These men had made a living on the sea, but they were in real trouble. And in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them walking on the sea. The fourth watch was around 3 a.m. That means they had been floundering on the water now for about 8 hours. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It's a ghost!" And they cried out for fear. I'm certain they weren't expecting to see anyone walk out on the water toward them. It shocked the disciples. They really didn't know what to think. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer. It is I. Do not be afraid." Hey, when you're in trouble, Jesus always comes to us, but often in ways that we don't expect. He comes, but he comes in ways we don't expect. You know, we think one moment that the Lord is nowhere. Then suddenly, he's now here. Same letters, just a different perspective, aren't they? Here's good news. Sudden storms are as much a part of the Christian life as supernatural surprises. That's why we need to be on the lookout for both. When a storm arises, don't panic. Look for Jesus walking on the water. He'll come bringing you good cheer.
You've been listening to Sandy Adams Radio with our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams, here at Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the Gospel of Matthew, where we see the call of Jesus to live radically different lives as his disciples. One of the most striking aspects of Matthew's gospel is how Jesus challenges his followers to embrace a new kind of righteousness, one that exceeds the righteousness of the Pharisees. In Matthew 5, he speaks of loving our enemies, going the extra mile, and forgiving those who wrong us, teachings that go against the natural instincts of this world. Jesus calls us to live a life of sacrifice and selflessness, where our actions reflect the love of God and His kingdom, not the standards of the world. As we reflect on these radical commands, we're invited to ask, how does God want to transform my heart and life to reflect His love more fully? If you enjoyed this message and want to hear more, visit our website at sandyadams.org. While you're there, check out Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain under the About tab. If you're in the Atlanta area, why not come visit us? We have services at 9:15 and 11:15 a.m. every Sunday. There's more information and directions at sandyadams.org. That's about all we have time for today. We hope you join us again in the coming edition of Sandy Adams Radio.